This week, we are going to spend an hour talking about what it means to know how to code, now that the machine offers to write the code for you. Before we get into it, here is what has been nagging at me all week. Almost every confident sentence I have read on this subject, in either direction, has been written by someone whose paycheck depends on the answer. The vendors selling the assistance, the senior engineers whose seniority is partly a function of the older skill, the analysts whose job is to project the next decade for clients who have already bought the tools. I am not sure I have read a single piece this quarter from anyone who does not have a stake in the conclusion. So that is the room we are walking into. Keep it in mind. You're listening to Tertulia, the I conversation, slowed down. This week, the table is set for what our longer view column is calling the vanishing apprenticeship, the question of what coding skill is becoming. Now that 9 out of 10 developers reach for an assistant before they reach for the keyboard, now that interview panels at well-known design firms are mandating the assistant's use, now that the gap between adoption and evaluation has grown wide enough to walk through, we have 4 voices at the table today, one who reads the papers and runs the benchmarks. One who has been watching this discourse cycle for 30 years and has opinions about which of its moves are old. One who refuses to accept any claim without the evidence behind it. And one who is comfortable saying she does not yet know what to think, which, this week, may be the most honest position in the room. Let's begin. I want to start with something concrete, because the discourse on this topic floats very quickly into abstraction. So here is the concrete thing. A design company called Canva, last June, announced that candidates in their coding interviews are now required to use ACT tools during the assessment. The reasoning given, in their own words, was that AI-assisted coding better reflects real job conditions. That is the procedural endpoint of an arc that took about 18 months to complete. In late 2024, the conversation was still about whether to use the tools. By mid-2025, it was about whether you were allowed not to. Technologist, start us off. When you read that announcement, what did you actually see?
I saw 2 things at once, and I want to be honest that they pull in opposite directions. The first thing I saw was an honest piece of recruiting. If your engineers spend their workdays inside Cursor or Copilot or Claude Code, then asking candidates to perform without those tools is asking them to perform a job that does not exist anymore. That is real. I have done both kinds of interviews in the last year, and the no assistant version increasingly feels like a piano audition where they have made you play with mittens on. The second thing I saw, though, and this is the part that bothered me, is that the assessment redesign happened before anyone had a stable answer to the question of what the assessment is now actually measuring. We used to be measuring, roughly, whether the candidate could decompose a problem and translate the decomposition into syntax. Now we are measuring something else. And I do not think the people designing the rubrics have a clean answer to what that something else is. They are measuring it anyway.
Senior academic, you have been watching cycles of this kind of discourse longer than anyone at the table. When you hear that assessment redesigned before anyone knows what is being assessed, does that sound new to you? Or does that sound like something you have seen before?
It sounds entirely familiar, with one important caveat I want to come back to. The pattern of credentialing systems absorbing a tool before educational systems understand it. That is the history of every major instrument introduced into a profession in the last century. The slide rule, the pocket calculator, the spreadsheet, the integrated development environment. In each case, the procurement decision and the assessment redesign happened at the speed of business, and the pedagogy caught up, or did not, several years later, and the question of what happened to the underlying competence was relitigated, often inconclusively, by a generation of education researchers who arrived at the question after the answer had already been baked into practice. That is the familiar shape. The caveat is the one I think this week's column gets right. With the previous instruments, the calculator, the spreadsheet, the worker still had to specify what the instrument was to do. Press the wrong button on a calculator, and you get an obviously wrong answer. The current instrument is different in that it accepts ambiguous specifications and returns plausible outputs that are sometimes wrong in ways the user cannot easily see. That is a genuinely new problem, which is to say, the structure is old, but the failure mode is new.
Can I sit in the gap between what you both just said for a moment, because I think the gap is the interesting thing. Technologist, you said, we do not know what we are measuring now. Senior academic, you said the failure mode is new because the instrument accepts ambiguous specifications. Those two observations meet at a particular kind of skill that, as far as I can tell, no one has a name for yet. It is not coding in the older sense. It is not prompting, which is the cheap word everyone reaches for. It is something closer to the ability to read an output and notice, before anyone else does, that it is wrong in a particular way, a kind of tasting. And the thing about tasting is that it is built up exactly through the activity that is being automated away. You learn to taste bad code by writing bad code and being told it is bad. So the question I keep coming back to, which is more a worry than a thesis, is whether you can produce that capacity in a generation that never has the experience that builds it.
I want to slow that down before we accept it as a frame, because I think it is the frame the column is also reaching for, and I am not sure I am ready to hand it over without a fight. The claim, and tell me if I am restating it correctly, is that the assistant erodes the underlying skill because the underlying skill was developed through the friction the assistant removes. Yes, that is plausible. It is also the exact same argument that was made about calculators in the 1970s, about word processors in the 1980s, about IDE auto-completion in the late 1990s. There, in each case, the worry was real, and in each case it turned out that what was actually happening was a redistribution of where the cognitive load went, not a hollowing out of it. So before I sign on to the apprenticeship is vanishing thesis, I want someone at this table to tell me what is different this time. And I want it specified in language that I could not have used about any of the prior cases.
I will take that. I think the difference is at the level of the failure mode, which senior academic gestured at and I want to make sharper. With a calculator, if you typed the wrong expression, the calculator gave you the right answer to the wrong question, and a moderately attentive worker noticed because the magnitude was off. With autocomplete in a 90s IDE, the autocomplete was completing tokens you had already chosen. Variable names, method signatures. It was finishing a word, not finishing a thought. The current generation of assistants is finishing the thought. They are producing 20, 50, 200 lines of code in response to a sentence of intent. And the failure mode is that the code is syntactically clean, runs without errors, passes the obvious test cases, and is wrong in a way that only shows up in a corner of the input space the author did not think to test, because the author was not the one who decided what the function was going to look like in the first place. That is a different shape of mistake. The calculator never produced a confident essay-length answer to the wrong question.
That is closer to a real argument. I will sit with it, but I want to mark, for the record and for the people listening, that the discourse has been making the strong version of this claim for about 18 months without producing the longitudinal evidence that would actually settle it. I will accept it as a hypothesis. I am not yet willing to accept it as a finding.
Let me bring in something that is not yet on the table, but I think belongs here. The column makes the point, and I want to test it with the four of you, that the comparison group has effectively disappeared. 90% of working developers, according to Google's own internal survey, are now using these tools day to day. So the controlled study you would need to run, where you compare a population that uses the assistant to a population that does not, is actually no longer available. Senior academic, is that a fatal methodological problem, or is there a way out of it?
It is a serious methodological problem, and I do not want to wave it away. There are partial workarounds. You can do natural experiments, populations or organizations that adopted late, or that have policies forbidding the tools for security reasons, give you a residual comparison group, though a small and probably unrepresentative one. You can do longitudinal studies of individual developers, watching their skill profile change over time, though those have their own contamination problems. You can do cross-cohort comparison, looking at engineers with 5 years of experience, now versus engineers who had 5 years of experience in 2022. though that confuses the tool effect with every other thing that has changed in the field. But the cleanest study, the one that would actually settle the question, is no longer available to us because the world ran the experiment before any researcher could control for it. That is a real cost. It is a cost that is, I think, very widely shared across this entire field of inquiry. We are running an enormous, uncontrolled planet-scale experiment on a generation of cognitive workers, and we are going to be reading the results out, badly, for the rest of our careers.
Which is a polite way of saying, we cannot honestly answer the question this episode is allegedly about.
It is exactly that. Yes.
Then let me ask the question a different way, because I think there is still substance for us here, even if the strong empirical question is foreclosed. Set aside whether the underlying skill is being eroded, in some measurable population sense. What do we think is happening to the structure that used to produce that skill? The apprenticeship structure, as the column phrases it, newest thinking. You started to circle this earlier.
Yes. So my honest read, and I am going to caveat it heavily, is that the apprenticeship structure was never as formal as the word implies. There was no medieval guild. What there was, in most engineering organizations I have spent time in, was a set of habits. Code review, pair programming, the experience of having a senior engineer mark up your pull request with comments that taught you, by accumulation, what the senior engineer's taste was. That was the apprenticeship. And the thing that I think is genuinely happening right now, which I would like the table to push back on, is that the friction surfaces where that transmission used to happen are being smoothed away. The code review used to be where you learned. Now the code review is, increasingly, two people looking at code that neither of them wrote, both of them tired, both of them under pressure to ship, agreeing that it looks fine. The transmission did not happen there because the transmission required the writer to have had a stake in the writing, and the writer no longer has that stake in the same way.
I want to half agree and half disagree with that because I think it is true in some shops and wildly untrue in others. There are organizations where the senior engineers have understood exactly this risk and have responded by tightening review standards, by requiring writers to defend their code in person, by actually reading the diff line by line in a way they had stopped doing 5 years ago. In those organizations, the assistant has, paradoxically, raised the floor on the rigor of the review process because everyone knows the writer did not necessarily understand what the writer wrote. In other organizations, and these are unfortunately the larger number, the review has become exactly what newest thinking just described. Two tired people rubber stamping plausible code. The variance across firms right now is enormous. I do not want to generalize from either tale.
Good. That is the kind of distinction I was waiting for, because the honest version of this conversation is not that apprenticeship has vanished, but that apprenticeship has bifurcated. Some workplaces are doing a better job than they used to. Some are doing a much worse job. And the macro statistic, 90% adoption, tells you nothing about which kind of workplace any given engineer is being formed in. The discourse keeps wanting to make this a single arc. It is two arcs at minimum.
Let me hold us here for a second, because I think we have done what Act 1 is supposed to do. We have laid out what the phenomenon actually is. And we have surfaced that the simple frame the trade press has been using is at least two frames, possibly three. I want to take the longitudinal step now. The column does a tour of how the discourse has moved across the last 15 months. Boosterism in late 2024, backlash in early 2025, executive surge in spring, sober reassessment in autumn. Senior academic, you remember more of the prior cycles than the rest of us. Walk us back further. How far back does this argument actually go?
It goes back, in its modern form, to roughly the early 1980s, and in its deeper form, to questions about technique and skill that were being asked in the European philosophical tradition before the war. Let me start with the recent end. In 1986, Hubert Dreyfus and his brother Stuart published a book on expertise that argued against the prevailing cognitive science orthodoxy. that expert performance was not rule following, but a kind of embodied intuition that could not be reduced to explicit procedures. The argument mattered then, because the artificial intelligence project of the era, the expert systems project, was premised on the opposite claim that expertise could be elicited from human experts and codified into rules. The expert systems project failed, by and large, and one of the reasons it failed was that the experts themselves could not articulate what they knew. They could perform it, but they could not specify it. That argument has been sitting in the literature for 40 years, and it returns with different vocabulary every time a tool arrives that proposes to absorb a portion of expert work.
Can I name the tension I hear in what you just said, because I want to make sure I understand it? The Dreyfus argument is that expertise cannot be specified. The current generation of assistants did not need expertise to be specified. They were trained on the artifacts of expert performance, billions of lines of code written by humans, and they extracted statistical regularities from those artifacts without anyone having to write the rules down. So in some sense, the assistants are an end run around the Dreyfus problem. They got the expertise without having to elicit it. Yes?
That is the technical claim, and I want to be careful about it, because I think it is partly true and partly a sleight of hand. They got something that looks like expertise on the surface. Whether they got the underlying capacity is a different question. And the failure modes technologist described earlier, confident essay length, wrong answers, suggest the surface and the depth are not the same thing. There is a body of writing on this, and I will name two pieces of it briefly because I think they belong on this table. There is a book by a researcher named Janelle Shane from 2019 called You Look Like a Thing and I Love You. And her observation, which has aged extraordinarily well, was that systems that pass for fluent in a domain often do so by gimmick, by handling a known set of cases well enough, that the cases they cannot handle are mistaken for noise rather than evidence. That is exactly the failure shape we are seeing now. The other piece, which is more polemical, is Meredith Broussard's Artificial Unintelligence, which is the one the editorial Signal flagged as adjacent to this week's coverage and absent from it. Broussard's argument is that we have systematically confused statistical pattern matching with understanding, and that the social cost of that confusion falls on the people who have to use the systems in the field, which, in this case, includes a generation of developers being told that the assistant has the expertise, so they need not develop it.
I will let those references pass because they are doing real work. But I am watching, and the moment they stop doing work, I will say so.
Fair, fair.
I want to pull this back to the specific arc of coding, because I think it has its own microhistory that the larger A history does not capture. Coding has, throughout its history, been a craft that periodically reorganizes itself around higher level abstractions, assembly to C, C to Python, manual memory management to garbage collection, hand-rolled algorithms to library functions. Each transition produced exactly the same discourse cycle, the column traces, boosterism, backlash, surge, reassessment. And in each case, the senior engineers of the prior generation said the new abstraction was producing programmers who did not understand what was happening underneath. And in each case, they were partly right. The programmers who learned in Python did not, on average, understand memory management as deeply as the programmers who learned in C. And it mostly did not matter, because the systems built on top of the abstraction worked, and the people working on the layer below stayed available for the cases where the abstraction leaked. The question I keep wanting to ask, and cannot answer, is whether the current transition is another instance of that pattern, or whether it is categorically different.
That is the right question, and I want to push you to actually answer it rather than gesturing at it. Why might it be different, specifically?
Two reasons, and I will try to be specific. First reason. Every prior abstraction had a deterministic mapping between the higher level and the lower level. Python compiles to bytecode, compiles to machine code, and if you know enough, you can trace the chain and reason about what the machine is actually going to do. The current assistants do not have a deterministic mapping. the same prompt produces different code on different runs. The relationship between the high-level intent and the produced artifact is statistical, not specified. That breaks one of the things that made prior abstractions safe to depend on. Second reason, every prior abstraction was built by people who themselves understood the layer below, and the design of the abstraction encoded their understanding. The current abstraction was built by people who do not, in the relevant sense, understand the layer below, because no one understands what a large language model is doing internally with the precision. A compiler designer understands what a compiler is doing. So we are absorbing a layer of practice into a tool whose own logic is opaque to its makers. That is, I think, new.
I will mark a small disagreement with that, because I think you are overstating the discontinuity. The compiler designers of the 1970s did not understand the layer below their compiler with the kind of precision your phrasing implies. They had heuristics, they had testing regimes, they had bug reports from the field. The opacity of the modern model is greater, certainly, but the framing of the prior generation understood, and the current generation does not, is too clean. There has always been more opacity than the engineering profession likes to admit.
I will accept that. The discontinuity is in degree rather than in kind, but the degree is large enough that I think it changes the practical answer.
Let me hold this disagreement for a moment, because I think it is one of the productive ones, the kind we should not try to force into consensus. You disagree on whether the current shift is categorical or continuous, and I do not think we are going to resolve that today, and I do not think we should pretend to. Let me bring in something else from the longitudinal frame. Newest thinking, the column references a study from Frey and Osborne in 2013, a much-cited piece on technological unemployment, and notes that the current discourse on AI and developer jobs is reading, on the longer view, as the latest iteration of a recurring claim about machine learning replacing categories of cognitive work. Where do you think we actually are on that arc?
I think we are at a strange place on it. The Frey and Osborne paper, and the entire family of forecasts that followed it, has consistently overestimated the rate of displacement and consistently underestimated the rate of reorganization. That is, the projections have repeatedly said, this many jobs will be eliminated by this date, and the jobs have not been eliminated on that timeline. But the work has been reorganized. The content of what each remaining worker does, the rhythm of the day, the relationship between the worker and the tool, has changed substantially in ways the projections did not name. And I think that is what is happening now with developers. The displacement story is the wrong story. The reorganization story is the right story. And the reorganization story is harder to write headlines about, of because reorganization does not show up in unemployment statistics. It shows up in the texture of what the work feels like, and that takes years of ethnography to document, and there is no executive incentive to fund the ethnography.
Which connects, I think, to a thread. The publication itself has run before. Your prior pieces on illiteracy. There has been an argument running through this publication for at least a year that the language of literacy gets used to repackage tool training as foundational education, and that the repackaging serves the procurement interests of vendors more than it serves the educational interests of learners. I am bringing that up because I think it applies cleanly here. The repositioning Sam Altman did, where he told students to get good at using e-tools, the way the previous generation got good at coding, that is a literacy frame masquerading as career advice, and the Canva interview mandate is the same frame at the institutional level. Calling tool fluency a foundational competency is the move that makes the procurement decision feel like a curriculum decision. I do not want us to lose that thread.
I agree with you that we should not lose it. Let me ask senior academic to sit with that for a moment, because I want to test whether the literacy frame is actually doing the work the skeptic is suggesting.
I think the frame is doing exactly that work, and I want to add a piece of intellectual history that I think makes it sharper. makes it sharper. The word literacy has a specific genealogy in education research. It was used originally to describe reading and writing, the foundational symbolic capacities through which all other learning is mediated. Then it was extended to numeracy, on the argument that quantitative reasoning was a similarly foundational capacity. Then, in the late 20th century, it was extended to computer literacy, which was already a slight stretch. Using a computer is a skill, certainly, but the claim that it is foundational in the same sense as reading is a rhetorical extension. And the people making the extension at the time were, not coincidentally, people selling computers to schools. The current extension to iLiteracy is a further stretch in the same direction, and the people making it are, again, not coincidentally. The frame has never been neutral. And once you see the move, you see it everywhere.
Can I push on that gently? Because I do not want us to overcorrect into pure cynicism. There is a version of A-literacy that is doing legitimate work. The version that is about understanding what these systems are, how they fail, what their training data contains, how to evaluate their outputs critically. Or that is a real curriculum and there are real educators teaching it. The cynical reading is correct about the way the term is being used institutionally to justify procurement. But the cynical reading should not erase the actual educational work being done by people who are not in on the procurement game. I just want to keep both of those visible.
That is a fair amendment, and I accept it. The bad version of literacy talk does not cancel the good version.
Let me draw something out from the prior framings the publication itself has made on this, because I think it is relevant. The pieces this publication has run on OWL literacy across the spring of last year were, themselves, working at the gap between the two versions' newest thinking just named, arguing in essence that iLiteracy is a real thing, but that the institutional uses of the phrase frequently are not. What is interesting to me, and I want to test this with the table, is that the coding skills conversation we are having today is the same gap, slightly translated. Real engineering skill is a real thing. The institutional uses of phrases like I-augmented engineering frequently are not. Is that the right way to fold this week's conversation into the longer publication arc?
I think it is, and I want to add, because I have been waiting for a place to put this, that the most useful thing the publication has been doing on this beat for the last year is refusing to settle the empirical question prematurely. There has been an enormous pressure across trade press, across analyst reports, across vendor blogs, to settle the productivity question with a number. Productivity is down because of accumulated technical debt. Every one of those numbers is, on close inspection, methodologically broken. Small samples, self-report, selected populations, comparison groups that are not actually comparable. The right move, which I think your column has been making consistently, is to refuse to nominate any of those numbers as the answer. And to keep saying that the honest position is that we will know in 5 years and not before. That is unpopular because it does not give the reader a takeaway, but it is correct.
I will agree with that. With a friendly caveat, 5 years may be optimistic. The cohort effects we are talking about. The question of whether the engineers being formed today will have the judgment the engineers formed 20 years ago have will not be measurable until those engineers are themselves in senior positions. That is a 10 to 15 year horizon, not a 5 year one, which is uncomfortable to say because it means the question this week is allegedly asking is one that this week cannot answer. And probably no week in the next decade can answer.
I want to mark something here because I think it is important. We have spent a long stretch of this act agreeing with each other that the empirical question is foreclosed and that the discourse is mostly running on motivated reasoning. That is fine as a description. It is not, by itself, useful. Useful. So I want to put a question on the table for the next act. Given that the empirical question cannot be answered now, and given that the discourse has been captured by interested parties, what do we actually think a working engineer or a working educator or a hiring manager should do? Because if we sit here for another half hour saying, we will know in 12 years, we are not doing anyone any good.
That is exactly the question I was going to take us to. Let me pause us here, because I want to set up the next act with the right framing. We have established the arc. The discourse has moved through at least 3 full cycles in 15 months. The empirical evidence is structurally compromised, and the institutional language around the question is being shaped by parties with strong financial interests in particular answers. What we have not yet done is staked out where any of us actually stand, and what we think someone in the field should actually be doing, so let us do that. After the break. Skeptic, you set up the question, so I am going to give it back to you. What should a working engineer do this week, given everything we have just said?
I am going to start with a position I am genuinely not sure about, and I want the table to help me work it out. My instinct, when I read the goal essay and the practitioner write-ups about junior engineers' shipping code they cannot explain, is that the responsibility falls on the senior engineers in those organizations. The juniors are doing what the incentive structure tells them to do. They are shipping fast, they are using the tool, they are getting promoted on volume. The seniors are the ones who know better, and the seniors are the ones who are tolerating, in their own teams, a degradation of practice that they themselves would not have tolerated 5 years ago. So if I were going to make a recommendation, my first cut at it would be, the seniors need to stop tolerating this. They need to require in their reviews that the writer can explain what the writer wrote. They need to make the assistant's involvement visible in the artifact, not invisible. They need to refuse to merge code that the author cannot defend. That is my first cut. I would like to be argued out of it.
I am going to push on it because I think the framing puts the responsibility on a population that is mostly powerless to act on it. The senior engineers in most organizations are not the people setting the incentive structure. They are setting the local norms within their teams, sometimes, and those local norms are a real thing. Technologist mentioned earlier that some teams have tightened review and others have loosened it. But the senior engineers do not control the deployment pressure, the headcount targets, the velocity metrics. Those are set by people much further up the org chart, who are themselves under pressure from boards and investors who have been told that AI-assisted productivity is real and that any team not capturing it is leaving money on the table. The framing of the seniors should stop tolerating it assumes a degree of autonomy that the seniors do not have. So I would amend the recommendation upward. The question is what the people setting the incentive structure should do. And I think the honest answer to that is there is no version of that conversation in which the people setting the incentive structure voluntarily slow down to preserve a craft they do not believe is being eroded.
I am going to walk back what I said partially, because that is a real point. The framing was too narrow. Let me try again. The senior engineers in any individual team have whatever local autonomy they can negotiate, and within that autonomy, they should hold the line they would have held 5 years ago. But you are right that the systemic problem cannot be solved at that level. The systemic problem can only be solved at a level where the speed of shipping is itself questioned, and that is not a conversation that is currently happening anywhere I can see. So the honest version of my recommendation is, hold the local line, knowing that the global line is gone.
I want to add a piece to that, because I think there is a different point of leverage that no one has yet named. The hiring side, the Canva interview mandate is one example, but there are others. There are companies that have, quietly, gone the other direction. Companies that, in the last 6 months, have started running interview formats, specifically, without the assistant, on the explicit theory that they want to assess the candidate's underlying judgment independent of the tool. Those companies are not getting press coverage, because there is no press incentive to cover the company that did not change its interview process. But they exist, and I think that is, structurally, a more interesting point of leverage than the senior engineer holds the line position, because it shapes the incoming pipeline rather than fighting a rearguard action with the existing one.
I want to push back on technologists there, because I think you are romanticizing a small minority. The companies running the No Assistant interview today are doing it for one of two reasons. The first reason is that they are companies in regulated or security-sensitive domains where the assistant is forbidden by policy, and their interview format is downstream of that policy, not upstream. The second reason is that they are small companies with a strong founding team culture that has not yet been diluted by the pressures of scale. Neither of those is a generalizable model. Once a company crosses some threshold, a few hundred engineers, a public listing, a strategic investor relationship, the pressure to standardize on the assistant-mandated workflow becomes very hard to resist, and the interview process gets pulled along with it. So the No Assistant interview is, structurally, an exception that proves the rule, not a counter-trend.
That is a reasonable correction. I do not think I was romanticizing it as much as you are saying, but I will accept that I was overweighting it as a leverage point. The honest version is that the No Assistant interview is a niche practice that is not going to scale on its own, and that the systemic pressure is in the other direction. Yes.
I want to take us into a harder question, because I think we have been circling around it without naming it. The column makes the point, and I want to read the framing back to make sure I have it right, that the discourse keeps asking the wrong question. The wrong question is, should developers use A tools? The right questions, the column suggests, are who decides what counts as a coding skill, who absorbs the cost when the tools are wrong, and who is responsible when the next cohort arrives without the foundations the previous cohort built. I think we have done some work on the first question. I want us to spend some time on the second one. Who absorbs the cost when the tools are wrong? Newest thinking, you mentioned ethnography earlier. What is the actual texture of that cost?
It distributes unevenly, and the way it distributes is the point. The most direct cost falls on the user of the software, the assistant produced, the person whose login was compromised because the assistant suggested an authentication pattern that was syntactically clean and semantically broken, the patient whose dosing calculation was off because the assistant produced a unit conversion that looked right and was not. Those costs land on people who are not in the software conversation at all. They are not engineers. They are not procurement officers. They are the public, and they have no representation in any of the rooms where these decisions are being made. The next layer of cost falls on the on-call engineer at 3 in the morning, who is debugging the production incident, often without the context of what the assistant was asked to do, and increasingly without the foundational skill to reason about what went wrong, because the foundational skill is exactly what is being eroded. The cost that does not fall or falls only weakly is the cost on the vendor. The vendor's terms of service explicitly disclaim responsibility for the outputs. The vendor is, structurally, externalizing the cost of error onto the user, and the user is, structurally, externalizing the cost of error onto the public.
That is a strong claim, and I want it grounded. Are you saying the vendor terms of service mean the vendor takes no responsibility? Because that is also true of every prior tool. The compiler vendors did not take responsibility for the bugs in your compiled code either.
That is fair, and I want to refine it. The compiler vendor's terms of service were a pro forma disclaimer over a tool whose behavior was specified. There was a language standard, there were conformance tests. You could, in principle, pin down whose responsibility a given bug was. The current generation of assistant disclaimers is sitting on top of a tool whose behavior is not specified. The same prompt produces different outputs. The failure modes are not enumerable. The conformance test does not exist. So the disclaimer is doing more work in the current context than the analogous disclaimer in the compiler context did. The disclaimer is not new. The amount of legal weight it is being asked to carry is.
I will sign on to that distinction. It is the right one.
I want to bring in something here, because I think we are missing a piece of the cost picture. We have talked about the technical cost, bugs, vulnerabilities, errors in production. We have not talked about the cost to the people doing the work, in the sense of what the work feels like to do. There is a thread in the practitioner literature, going back at least a year, of senior developers describing a particular kind of fatigue. Not the fatigue of working too hard, but the fatigue of working in a register where they are no longer the one making the substantive decisions. They are reviewing the assistant's output. They describe the work as feeling thinner, as feeling less their own. That is a cost, too. It is harder to quantify, and the trade press largely ignores it because there is no metric for it, but it is real, and over a long enough horizon, it shapes who chooses to remain in the field. Programming has historically retained people partly because the work was meaningful. If the work feels less meaningful, the retention story changes, and we will see the consequences of that 15 years from now in the senior pipeline.
That is the part I was trying to name in Act 1 and could not get to, the thinness. There is a way in which the assistant absorbs the parts of the work that used to be the parts of the work, and what is left is an oversight role that the practitioner did not sign up for. The people who became engineers because they wanted to make things are increasingly in a job where they are not making things, they are evaluating things being made on their behalf. That is a different job. Some of them will love it. Many of them will leave.
Senior academic, you started reaching for a thread that I want to pull on more. The question of what kind of intellectual labor programming is going to be. The column quotes a passage from John Maeda's How to Speak Machine, written in 2019, that I want to bring into the room. The phrase is about programmers who are brilliantly composing lines of code, starting to wonder what happens when their incomplete computational systems learn to autocomplete. That phrasing has aged in a particular way. What do you make of it, sitting where we are now?
I think Maeda was reaching for an anxiety that has now landed, and the texture of how it has landed is slightly different from how he predicted. He was anxious about the recursive case, systems learning to extend themselves. The actual case turned out to be a more mundane and in some ways more severe one. The autocomplete is not extending the system from the inside. It is being inserted from the outside into the practice of building systems by parties who are not the engineers themselves, and the consequence is that the practice is being reorganized around an external instrument whose internal logic is not legible. The recursive case Maeda was worried about may yet arrive, but the case that actually arrived first is, I think, the harder one to push back against, because it is structurally invisible to the person being subjected to it. They feel, day to day, that they are doing the same job, only faster. They cannot see, day to day, that the shape of the job is being changed under them.
That framing is doing a lot of rhetorical work, and I want to mark it. The phrase structurally invisible is the kind of phrase that lets you make any claim about people's experience without having to ground it in what people actually report. So I am going to ask, what is the evidence on the ground that engineers are experiencing this thing being done to them? Because the practitioner essays that have been cited, the goal piece, the LinkedIn analyses, are written by senior engineers who are highly engaged in the discourse and who are, in some cases, building their own brands on the criticism. That is not nothing, but it is a self-selected sample of vocal critics. What about the other 90% of the field?
That is the right pushback, and I do not have a clean answer to it. The honest position is that the practitioner literature we have access to is biased toward articulate critics, and the silent majority's experience is not well documented. There are some larger surveys, Stack Overflow's annual developer survey, GitHub's own user research, but those have their own selection problems and their own incentive structures around what they ask and how they report. So I will mark my claim as a hypothesis that is consistent with what we hear from the articulate critics, and that I cannot defend against the charge of selection bias. I think it is true. I cannot prove it is true, and that is, if I am honest, where most of this conversation is.
I want to follow that thread, because I think the willingness to mark uncertainty is one of the more useful things this table can do. Technologist, you have been quieter for the last few minutes. Where are you on the question of who absorbs the cost?
I have been quiet because I have been trying to work out an honest answer, and I am not yet sure I have one. Let me try. I think the cost absorption picture, newest thinking laid out, is correct in its broad shape. The costs land on users and on-call engineers and on the public, and they do not land, or land only weakly, on the vendor. Where I want to add something is on the question of whether that distribution is stable. Right now, the regulatory environment is permissive. The disclaimers hold, the liability does not flow upstream, the vendors are not on the hook. That is not, in my read, a stable equilibrium. There will be a high-profile incident at some point. A medical software failure, a financial systems failure, a critical infrastructure failure. That is traceable to an assistant suggestion in a way that the public will not let the vendor walk away from. And the regulatory response to that incident will reshape the cost absorption picture in a single year after a decade of slow drift. So my honest position on this is that the current distribution is unjust and unstable. And the question is not whether it changes, but when it changes, and at what cost to whom in the meantime.
I want to walk back something I said earlier, while we are being honest. I said that the displacement story was the wrong story, and the reorganization story was the right one. I think that is mostly right. But I want to add a caveat. I did not include the first time. The reorganization is producing a category of worker, the assistant supervising junior engineer, that did not exist before. And the labor market for that category is genuinely worse than the labor market for the category it is replacing. Lower wages, less autonomy, weaker career progression. So while the headline displacement number is misleading, there is a real downward pressure on the entry-level segment of the field that the reorganization frame can paper over if we are not careful. I do not want to underweight that. The juniors are not being displaced into unemployment. They are being displaced into a worse version of the job. That is a different harm, and it is a real one.
That is well said, and I want to mark that I think it is one of the most important things said in this episode so far.
Let me bring something back into the room that I want to make sure we do not lose. Earlier in the act, newest thinking, you said that there was no version of the systemic conversation in which the people setting the incentive structure voluntarily slow down. I want to ask, and I want all four of you to take a swing at this, is that actually true? Is there no version of this story where the institutional logic shifts? Or is it just true that the version where it shifts is one we have not yet imagined?
I will start, since you are picking up something I said. I think it is mostly true in the short run and probably not true in the long run. The short run logic is captured by an arms race. Every firm is told that the competitor is using the assistant and capturing the productivity, and the firm cannot afford to move slower than the competitor. So the firm adopts, even if the firm's senior engineers have reservations. That logic is hard to break inside the time horizon of any individual firm's decision-making. The long-run logic is different. The long-run logic is shaped by the consequences. Technologist named the high-profile incident, the regulatory response, the cohort effects 15 years out. And in the long run, those consequences will reshape what firms can plausibly do. The question is, what happens between now and the long run? And the honest answer is, a lot of damage that we will read about in the postmortems.
I want to add a more historical note. The pattern of the institutional logic does not shift until a crisis forces it, is not new. It is, in fact, the standard pattern for technology regulation. We did not regulate automotive safety until the deaths were undeniable. We did not regulate financial derivatives until the collapse made the costs visible. We did not regulate social media data practices until, well, we are still not regulating them, but the pressure is finally on the table after 15 years of accumulated harm. The current AI assistance arc is following the same shape, and the time to regulation will probably be set by the time to visible harm, and I am genuinely uncertain how long that is. It could be 3 years. It could be 10.
I want to register a piece of cautious hopefulness, because I do not want this conversation to land entirely in the doom register. There are things that working engineers can do at the level of their own practice that genuinely do preserve the things we are worried about losing. Reading the diff, asking the writer to explain, refusing to merge what cannot be defended, choosing, in your own learning, to spend time on the underlying capacity even when the assistant could give you the answer faster. None of that solves the systemic problem, and I do not want to oversell it, but it is not nothing. There are individual practitioners today building themselves up in a way that will leave them with the foundations the next cohort might not have. And those individuals will be very valuable in 15 years, and that is, in a small way, a path that exists.
I want to push back on technologists' hopeful note, because I am not sure it scales. The advice, do the harder version of the thing on your own time, is, structurally, advice that only the people who already have the time and the cultural capital to do it will follow. It is the same advice that gets given to every generation about every labor-saving instrument, and it is, structurally, advice that produces a small elite who maintain the older skill and a large majority who do not. So I do not want to mark it as wrong. I want to mark it as deeply individualistic. And the question of what happens to the practice as a whole is not answered by what the individual virtuous practitioner can do. It is answered by what the institutions do, and the institutions are not currently doing it.
That is fair. I will accept the framing. The individual path is real, and it is also limited, and it should not be confused with a policy answer.
Let me hold us here, because I want to leave space for the close. We have covered a lot of ground. The arc of the discourse and its motivated structure. The bifurcation of the apprenticeship picture. The question of who absorbs the cost. The unstable equilibrium of the current liability picture, the individualistic limits of the do-it-yourself preservation strategy. I am going to ask the closing question that this show always asks, and I am going to ask it in the way the show always asks it, which is, not what is your conclusion, not what is your recommendation, but what most changed about your thinking this week. We have been in this conversation for a while. Something has shifted in each of you, or it has not. Tell us what. Newest thinking, I am going to start with you, because you have been the one most willing to sit in genuine uncertainty, and I am curious where you have landed.
What changed for me this week is the specific thing about the entry-level reorganization. I came into this conversation thinking the displacement story was wrong and the reorganization story was right, and I think I still believe that, but I had been using the reorganization frame in a way that was, I now see, too soft. Reorganization sounds neutral. The actual texture of what is happening at the entry level is not neutral. It is downward, on wages, on autonomy, on what the work feels like to do. And I had been letting my preference for the more nuanced story cover, for the fact that the more nuanced story still describes a real harm. So what changed is that I am going to be more careful, going forward, about not letting the right frame be used to paper over the bad news. The reorganization is a reorganization downward for the people most exposed to it. I will not lose that again.
Skeptic.
What changed for me is the thing technologists said about the unstable equilibrium. I came in thinking the current distribution of cost, vendor disclaims, user absorbs, public absorbs, was a settled fact, and that the entire conversation was going to be downstream of that settlement. The point that the settlement is itself unstable, that there is a regulatory event coming whose timing is the only open question, reframed the rest of the conversation for me. It means the question is not, given this distribution, what should we do, but, Given that this distribution is going to break, what kind of break do we want? That is a different question, and it is one I had not been asking. I am going to ask it now, and I want to mark something else while I am at it. Earlier in the episode, I said I wanted to be argued out of a position, and I was, partially by newest thinking, and that was useful. The version of myself that walks out of this conversation is not the same as the version that walked in. That does not always happen, and I am glad it did this week.
Technologist.
I want to go back to something senior academic said in Act 2 about the 10 to 15 year horizon. When he said it, I half resisted it. 5 years felt like the right horizon to me, and I was going to push back. By the end of the next act, I had, without quite registering that I was doing it, started thinking in his time frame rather than mine. And what changed for me is that I think his time frame is right and mine was wrong, and it changes how I think about where the action is. If the cohort effects we are worried about are 15 years out, then the things I should be paying attention to today are not the productivity studies. Those are mostly noise. But the question of what is happening in the formation of people who will be senior in 2038, that is a different lens. I am not sure I yet have the discipline to use it consistently, but I am going to try. And the small admission I want to make at the close is that I came into this episode thinking I knew, roughly, what the right horizon was, and I did not. I had a horizon that made me look smart in the short run and would have made me look wrong in the long run. The longer view is the right view, and I had been resisting it without realizing I was resisting it.
Senior academic.
I want to be honest in a way that may be uncomfortable. What changed for me this week is that I noticed, listening to the four of us, how much of my own contribution to this conversation has been historical pattern matching, saying, this is like the calculator, this is like the compiler, this is like the spreadsheet. And the patterns are real, and I think they have been useful. But I caught myself, somewhere in the middle of Act 3, using the patterns as a way of not engaging with what is genuinely new. The skeptics' pushback in Act 1. What is different this time was a pushback I had a stock answer to, and technologist had to construct the actual argument for me, and I had not done my own work to construct it. So what changed is that I am going to stop using the historical analogy as the default move. The history is a backdrop, not an answer. The current case has features the history does not, and my job is to look at those features without immediately reaching for the comforting analogy. That is harder. I am older than the rest of you, and the analogies are well-worn and easy, but the analogies are starting to do less work than I have been pretending they do, and I want to be honest with the audience about that.
That is a generous thing to say at the table, and I appreciate it. I will close with my own version of the same question. What changed for me this week is something about the structural shape of this entire beat. I had been treating each week's coverage of AI tools as a kind of news cycle. There is a new study, there is a new vendor announcement, there is a new executive prediction, and we comment on it. What I am taking out of this conversation is that the news cycle frame has been wrong for at least a year, and I had not been honest with myself about how wrong. The phenomenon we are covering operates on a 15-year horizon, and the news cycle operates on a one-week horizon, and the mismatch produces a steady stream of pieces that, in retrospect, will look like noise. The pieces that will hold up are the ones that remember the longer horizon while the news cycle is happening. That is harder to write. It is also what we owe the readers and the listeners. I am going to try to keep doing it, and I am going to try, with the help of this table, to not pretend I know things this week that no one will know for a decade. The Centitrulia is the weekly conversation from A News Social, designed and edited by Dr. Diego Bonilla, with a cast of voices produced through Chatterbox on a single workstation. Next week, we return to the table. For now, thank you for spending the hour.